When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Does picking an outfit have you running a little too fashionably late? We get it. Great taste takes time. That's why Drizly, the number one app for alcohol delivery, has your back with the largest selection of beer, wine, and spirits delivered in under 60 minutes. Convenience never goes out of style. So if you need to spend some extra time in the mirror instead of at the store, download the Drizly app or go to drizly.com. That's drizly.com today.
Do you have somebody cancel or something?
No, you know.
There's no way somebody didn't pick this.
You got a nice little Husker Du poster there over your shoulder.
Yeah, and check this out, dude.
Oh, look at that, man.
Yeah, I'm a big Husker Du fan.
So. Yeah, not surprising. You seem to like almost every band that at least one or two records, right? I'm amazed at how many different because I think I have a pretty wide palette, right? But then when I talk to someone like you, and it's just like, well, I guess I'm just kind of a novice.
Yeah, you see all these cases behind me. Those are full of CDs, and there's three more over here, and then I've got vinyls elsewhere. So yeah, I've spent way too much money on music over my
makes you happy, right? You know, exactly. Is that Eddie head? Is that just like a head, or is that the one there? Wasn't there one that like actually held CDs in it?
Oh, I think there was, but that's actually a mask.
Okay,
a couple of years ago, they had some company that put out a couple of different Eddie masks, and of course, I had to buy one.
Nice
for no reason at all.
All right. I'm talking to Kevin Williams of the In Obscuria podcast. Thank you for joining Whatever Never Mind, Kevin. How are you?
I am good, man. I'm stoked to be on and stoked for this episode.
This is a big record for me, man. So I was definitely looking forward to this one. They're funner when it's one that you don't have to do a lot of listening research. At least it is for me. Even though I still end up doing a deep dive on the record a few times leading up to it just to make sure I can remember everything properly. But this album, it wasn't too far from any CD player I had for, I don't know, a couple years. So
right on. Absolutely. When it was released. And I've had like, I don't know, at least four different copies of this thing over the years. I don't know about you, but
oddly enough, only two. I had the original release, and then I upgraded for that Psalms edition or whatever. That Satanos Siciliamos. Oh, I lost your audio.
What's that?
You froze. So it was all I saw was the CD for a second. What were you saying?
I was saying I got this from B&G. I don't know if you remember that.
B&G, yeah, oh yeah.
You get your one penny records.
Yeah, they were free for me.
right. And then of course I had to pony up for the latest vinyl copy of it as well.
That's on a mic, kind of like maybe I'll buy it because I see it every now and then, and it looks pretty fucking sweet. Have you busted it out and played it?
Oh yeah, I played it today actually. It sounds great. It's red vinyl. It's super beautiful.
Now the Ultra Mega OK, they actually did the whole hardcore dial down and remix thing properly with Jack and Dino. Is it the same kind of thing with that, or is it just like a remaster? Do you know the backstory there at all?
I don't know. I think it's just remastered because there's nothing significantly different about it when I hear it, to my ears at least. It doesn't have, like, I have the Ultra Mega OK version as well, but no, this is not that. The only thing this had was a lenticular cover, you know, big whoop.
Yeah, oh, that's pretty cool though. Are you a blue collar man when it comes to beer, or what are you drinking there? Is it some kind of snooty asshole stuff? What do you got?
I have Mexican beer, man.
Oh, Pacifico, this is the cheapest stuff, man. I can hammer a few of those down without too big of a complaint. Yeah.
Exactly. I couldn't decide between this or the Coors Light tonight, so I went with the Pacifico.
I just grab what's in the fridge, and it's almost always Coors Light. You dig deep enough, right. You'll get some leftovers from all the random stuff I buy here and there. But
exactly. I have some of the frou-frou stuff, but I just go for this.
Are we going to see you in Nashville this summer?
Yeah, man. We're going to be there.
Both of you.
Both of us, yeah. And I told my co-host, I said, we'll at least get, you know, either the kids' table in the back or maybe the table in the bathroom since we're the new guys.
But. Oh, right on. Do we even say the album we're talking about today? Soundgarden, their third record. I guess I should officially say, coming in at number two on Rolling Stone's Greatest Grunge Albums of All Time is the 1991 record from Soundgarden, Bad Motorfinger. This was released September 24th, 1991. It was produced by Terry Date and Soundgarden. It comes in at a pretty girthy 57 minutes and 42 seconds. Recorded at A&M Studios in Los Angeles. And had the singles Outshined and Rusty Cage. This also featured bassist Ben Shepherd, who replaced technically Jason Everman, but he was kind of a fill-in between Hiro Yamamoto, who played with them up through Louder Than Love and most of that tour. And then Jason Everman kind of filled in for a while, and then it just wasn't a good fit, apparently. And they got Ben Shepherd, who has the lowest guitar-to-crotch ratio that I can think of almost anybody. Kind of a cool look, if you ask me, but...
Yeah,
this record, man, was one of the biggest ones of this movement. I got into this more than Nirvana, but to me it was Outshine that really pulled me in. I had already heard Louder Than Love because I worked at the college radio station, but only because of that. It was a record I would play, and this was really a next big step for them. Where were you as far as timeline when this came out, as far as getting into it?
Did you know that this – I read something. Now, this may or may not be right, but – I read something that this came out the same day as Nirvana's Nevermind and Red Hot Chili Peppers' Blood Sugar Sex Magik. Is that true?
As far as I can confirm, I read the same thing, and I read something else saying that this came out 1 month later.
All I can really say is that I have no idea.
I found more information saying those three came out on the same day.
I mean, oh my God.
Yeah, no
That's
doubt.
Crazy. That is crazy. But yeah, so me, I was a freshman in college when this came out. So I grew up kind of a punk rock kid, skater kid. And then I discovered Iron Maiden and Metallica and got way into metal and ultimately got into hair metal. And when I started my college freshman year, I had this crazy collection of hair metal, thrash metal, punk, even prog rock. So I was all over the board even back then, but it was just an age of discovery for me because I was discovering all these different types of music. And when this came out, if it came out on the day that we were saying, I got Red Hot Chili Peppers, Blood Sugar Sex Magik. And that's probably my favorite album of the 90s, hands down.
It's a good one.
My roommate got Soundgarden Bad Motorfinger on cassette because we had heard the single. Right. And he got that. And we just together, that's what we would do is we'd each buy something different so we could, you know, have more music in our in our dorm room. And I just remember being blown away because prior to that, I had heard of Soundgarden and I had seen ads for Louder Than Love and Rip Magazine or something like that. And I knew that they were on SST, which is a, you know, punk rock label that I loved, but I'd never really tried to get into them. I hadn't really heard them. So hearing this album for the first time, it just blew me away. And of course it made me immediately go out and buy Louder Than Love like the next day.
They're very different records, man.
They are. But you know, at that time I was trying to be the snotty cool kid and have the stuff that came out before. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Not much has changed. I'm just older. I was trying to prove my cool points by I got Louder Than Love. I got the old stuff. Same thing with Nirvana. I didn't buy Nevermind. No, I went out and bought Bleach because I thought that'd give myself some cool
points. That's the move.
But I can't say that I had either of those prior to their big, you know, releases coming right out. So
I enjoyed Louder Than Love, and I still do, but this was just such a sonic step forward. And I don't know if it was the addition of Ben Shepherd. They do give him a lot of credit for kind of changing how they approach songwriting with this record as opposed to years prior. But, Chris Cornell was like just at a zenith level as a creator. I mean, he's coming off the Louder Than Love tour. He does the Temple of the Dog album, and he writes this fucking masterpiece. You know, it's just like, I don't know, he had help and all that stuff, but my God, everything he touched turned gold during this time, and he could do no wrong in my eyes. I had more than a man crush for this guy. I mean, he was easy on the eyes, you know, looked good. Yeah, I joke about it, but seriously, where does he get off? I mean, he's taller than everybody, better looking than everybody. He's in fucking amazing shape, and not a single person on the planet can touch him as a singer at this time. Fuck you, Chris Cornell.
Exactly. What an asshole.
You have too much.
Yeah, I agree, man. And he, his voice to me never sounded as good as this album. I know a lot of people probably argue that the next album he would be better, but I would say he never sounded as good as this one again.
I've never thought about it because, I mean, he sounds so good on Super Unknown and on Temple of the Dog. He just is just doing some amazing, but this record, there's not a bad note on it as far as him singing. It's just, man, he's so versatile. But
and this is kind of the last time, if you think about it, that some of that higher register stuff that he's hitting in this album, he doesn't really approach that again. And of course, he kind of left all that behind once he moved on to Audioslave. But
yeah, definitely.
Even on the albums after this, I don't think he ever hit those high highs again.
This was where he kind of showcased it, but you know, I mean, that shit probably sucks to go back to, you know, almost like Metallica following up Injustice for All with the Black Album. It's like, let's just play some like standard rock classics for a while. This 9 minutes of riffing is a bit much, but and Lars can't keep up anymore.
Well, and they decided to include some bass guitar as well, which I liked.
That's helpful. The album title Bad Motor Finger is supposedly a joke on the Montrose song Bad Motor Scooter. Okay, good enough. I just think it's a really cool word for a spark plug, if you ask me.
I actually thought it was a middle finger. I always thought that the spark plug and the bad motor finger, I thought that was them saying this is kind of a middle finger phrase. I don't know. It must not be true. That's just how I read it. Because if you look at a spark plug, it kind of does look like a bird.
Yeah, it really does. It kind of has that shape. You know, it's right there in the middle, too. And it was certified platinum in January 93. So kind of a slow grower, really, as far as the record sales. It didn't hit double platinum until April of 96. So sales-wise, Super Unknown is their biggest record. But I think it's obvious why this one is number two on this list and not Super Unknown. And I think they're both amazing albums, but it's not all about sales, man. A couple things from reviews. Spin Magazine, a woman named Lauren Spencer said, basically, they draw on older hard rock influences without sounding derivative. I think that's an excellent way of describing this band, especially at this time in this record. There is a ton of, like, especially Black Sabbath-y or even Zeppelin kind of feel to it. But at no time do you feel like you're listening to Sabbath or Led Zeppelin or any of their kind of influences, you know what I mean? Even fucking Fleetwood Mac would probably seep into their brain a bit.
Yeah, and I would even say I made a note in one of the songs where they get a little proggy in some of these bits, and I even reference King Crimson. They kind of have a little King Crimson vibe in some parts.
Yeah, I'm leaning on you for the more obscure references. I'm just going to knock it out of with Led Zeppelin and shit like that, Black Sabbath. You know, the easy ones. So you're the host of the In Obscuria podcast. You got to come up with the Obscuria.
I'll try.
I'm bringing the fire, baby. Oh, man. And then I also like to mention, when I have it, my favorite crusty record reviewer, Robert Christigo, was less impressed by this album. Of course, he was. The Village Voice writer at the time. I wonder if Robert Christigo is still alive. I'm not sure. He sounds like an old fucking man in 91. He says this was a credible metal record because of Thayil's impressive use of guitar noise, but less impressive lyrically. Chris Cornell howls on about looking for the paradigm in your Jesus Christ pose. I swear that's the good stuff. So, yeah, Robert Christigo, the old stick in the mud. Not one that gets invited to a lot of parties, that Mr. Christigo.
Yeah, completely disagree. I think the lyrics in this album are fantastic.
Man, Cornell is one of the better lyricists of all time, I think. I don't even want to just say for grunge. I just think he definitely has an elite level of not just the lyrics, but the melody and fitting to the music. And just, I don't know, you're trying too hard if you're going to nitpick or critique those in a negative way. But and one last thing I'd like to say is Buzz Osborne, whose band is largely the Melvins, is largely considered the, you know, by many people, this is what fucking grunge is. So he says this is his favorite grunge album of all time, officially ending any debate on whether or not this is a grunge record. There's been a lot of fun talk about that, like with many of the records, you know, people want to say, well, I don't know if this really belongs on this list, that kind of stuff. But
have you listened to it? It belongs on this list.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, this is sludgy so well. As fuck, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't heard that about this record in particular, but I like the fact that if Buzz Osborne is saying this is fucking grunge, it's a grunge album. Well, any other thoughts on the album before we get into it?
No, man. Let's dive in.
The record opens up with Rusty Cage.
Amazing Cornell vocals right out of the gate. And I would say this is for the albums that are at least on this top five list that you've been going through. This is the perfect album opener of any of these other albums.
Let's see. So we're talking Nevermind, spoiler alert.
10.
If people haven't figured out Nevermind's number one at this point, they're not. Yeah. So we got Nevermind. So it opens up with Teen Spirit. You have Rusty Cage. What's the Once is the opener on 10. Hole, Violet, right?
I don't even know.
and
never owned it.
And with Green River, yeah, it doesn't. It's not even going through that record. I found out it's not even. We're not sure what the first song is. So, yeah, hands down, it beats all those. I would put Once number two, and everything else don't really care. Although, I mean, I shouldn't shit on Nirvana because I'm not a fan. Teen Spirit is an amazing opening track. I mean, I use that kick drum at the beginning of my show here, but not that whole little drum fill that girl has there, but. Iconic as hell, and what a way to launch that album. But
agreed. And I'll say, for this being Ben Shepherd's first recorded output with Soundgarden, my God, the bass tone on this album, phenomenal. Just crushing the tone that he gets.
Playing with a pick on this tune, too. He's not normally a pick player, but this song, you really need that. You know what I mean? That for this, you kind of need that just heart attack. It really wouldn't work with that. I'm sure some bass player purist would hammer me for that, but they're wrong.
Well, I'm a bass player that plays with a pick, so fuck everyone else.
Yeah. When I play bass, I play with a pick, but that's largely because I'm not a bass player. But I always like that sound. I like the crispness. I prefer it. But there's times that I get that. I've played with really, I mean, the bass player in my band doesn't use a pick, and he gets amazing tone and stuff. But if we played this song, he'd have to fucking pick up a pick, man.
I don't know what else to say about this song. I'll go ahead and show my hand a little bit. I mean, this album to me, the first side is almost perfect. Yeah. I will just go ahead and say that we're going to go through the songs, but this is from a right out of the gate first couple of songs. You just can't beat it. me.
Well, I'll mention a couple of things. And to me, it is one of the greatest riffs pretty much that you ever hear. And it's made better with the harmony. There's actually three layers of different, slightly different. They're all high up, but you know they're just to give you that harmony sound that you hear. When they play it live, they obviously just pick two of those, but it's got that oddball tuning that basically this record really was their calling card going forward. They would use some drop D in the past, but this song I think is drop B. And then of course, you know, they end with that kind of odd time signature. Matt Cameron, the brilliance of Matt Cameron is just, I mean, I don't like to throw this term around lightly. Underrated. That guy deserves to be talked about in the realm of Neil Peart and Alex Van Halen. He is just, I don't know. I don't know if you're a guy who can pick this stuff up. I think it's fun. I try to. I'm guessing that that end part's 4/7, but I honestly couldn't get it for sure.
Oh God, no! Don't ask me to do time signatures. I love prog rock, but no, don't ask me to do math. So Matt Cameron, I mean, he did play on Geddy Lee's solo album, so that tells you something. Just the
I did
fact
not know
that. Yeah. So go pick up. I think it's My Perfect Headache is the name of it. I may have the title wrong, but it's a great album. But Geddy Lee's only solo album, Matt Cameron is the drummer, and he's phenomenal, man. There's a couple of songs where I point out that I feel like he started kind of a movement, that whole tribal drum thing. You think of Alice in Chains with that whole tribal drum thing a lot, but I really think it was Matt Cameron who made every band that came after them want to do that in every song.
Yeah, I mean, Sean Kenny, no slouch either, but I took him for granted. Now I'm getting at. I'm like, he's been on three records now for sure. I think actually more. I think he's on Ultra Mega OK, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, he's a drummer. Yeah.
So he's on four records on this list. But, you know, when you deep dive these things, I try to nitpick and be a little more attention to detail. This guy is so subtle. You know, that's part of the problem is that, like, you know, when you listen to Neil Peart and Alex Van Halen, those kind of drummers, they make it very difficult to not notice how fucking amazing they are. They do a great job of fitting the song, too. Just different kind of players are more bombastic, where Matt Cameron is like a guy who, like, well, like you said, a math nerd. I mean, how does this guy count this shit out even sometimes? It's like, I would hope it's more of a feel thing, but it doesn't seem like it's possible.
I would think that, a Neil or an Alex Van Halen, maybe they're more of a count out sort of drummer. Maybe not. But I actually get the sense that Matt Cameron is just a feel guy.
Okay.
Because it comes across because of the way that he's kind of in the pocket, yet it's still loose, everything that he's doing. But that's just my opinion. I could be totally wrong, and he could be a mathematician. Who knows?
Could be both.
Good point.
Why not? Honestly, it says a lot about Kim Thayil and Chris Cornell, because Cornell is even talking about, like, he's just at this point. Like, he even says Rusty Cage is, like, one of the early riffs he wrote when he started teaching himself guitar. So he was never really, you know, he was the drummer when the band started. And so he started teaching himself guitar and became a pretty solid guitar player, you know, from a songwriting stance. But being able to play with somebody that does those time signature shifts, you know, it can throw you off, yep. You know, and what a killer band.
Well, I wonder if he wrote it that way or if it came out that way as they were jamming it and Matt said, hey, try this. Like,
yeah, I didn't find anything specific. I know all these episodes I've done, there are definitely times where I read something where this band in particular would come with, like, here's the basis idea, and then they would jam it out, and then they would start working on that at another stuff, and that's where a lot of the songwriting credits would get built on. So,
now, is that the way that you guys did your band? Because I know that I've been in different bands where that was the approach, right? Somebody brings in a riff, and then you just jam it out until you figure it out.
The two most fruitful methods were I would either have something almost complete and bring it in, or towards the end I started working with our guitar player, Treble, and him and I would literally just sit down, and for about 4 hours, the goal was we leave with a rough demo of something. And yep. That was the most collaborative I ever worked. Now there's examples of other stuff, but jamming's never been my forte until the bulk of the song is done. And then, like, you start getting ideas with arrangements and different pieces and that nature. And maybe that's what you're talking about, but not a lot of, like, I see a band like Soundgarden probably be able to, they all kind of coalesce and work off each other. Where I've had the guitar player being one guy that I could probably do that with. The rest of the band was never around long enough. Dude. Yeah, you really got to commit the time to do that, man. It was tough enough getting them to come down to lay a drum track down some days.
I always like having most everything worked out, and then I get together with, if I get to work with my favorite drummer, his name's Ken Auberly, he always comes with kind of what I envision happening with Matt Cameron, where he goes, "This is great, but it's real straight. Let's try to mix it up a little bit. I'm going to hold off here. Then we, you know, we'll throw in some weird stuff." In my head, I don't know jack shit if that's the way it happens, but in my head, that's what I'm hearing. That's probably the way Soundgarden works, but who knows?
Yeah. I do enjoy when someone wants to try something. It's not a tough sell when we're jamming. It's all fun. It's music, right? You want to try changing something? Let's fucking try it. Let's see. Maybe it'll fucking, cause when it works, oh, it feels so good.
Exactly. When everybody's locked in. Yeah.
What about a rating system? I assume you've listened to a couple episodes. Did you come prepared today?
I'm prepared today, and I'm gonna switch it up on you, because we're gonna have a different rating every song.
I love it. Anyway, so what do we do? What are we doing for Rusty Cage, man?
Rusty Cage, you alluded to it earlier. Rusty Cage is going to get 5 bass guitars slung below your knees.
I also give this 5 bass guitars slung below the knees. Man, I wonder how that guy's back is. I mean, he watching him play, just it's almost painful, but it's also really cool looking, you know?
So he was still doing it. You saw him more recently, right?
Yeah, and it was not cool. White, he still had it low though, but he was not like the caveman hunch.
I sling mine pretty low, but the strap's starting to come up a little bit as I get older, man.
I have a thing. I mentioned it, but I think I invented it anyway. The guitar to crotch ratio has a lot to do with how cool you have to look cool playing guitar. There's just
absolutely,
if it's up by your tits, just I don't know, go do some flamenco or something like that. I just.
I've played with a guy who was a, you know, almost virtuoso type guitarist, but he played it up here, and I was just always like, I know that works for some bands, but dude, please put your guitar down. Yeah, we're a punk rock band.
Oh, God, exactly. You can't do it in punk. I mean, John 5 does it, and it's still kind of like, come on, just a little lower. You know, it's just like.
Yeah. Well, if you're not playing with your dick, you're not playing.
if you can see the crotch under the guitar, it's definitely too high. But look at that. That's what do they call those? The Dan Armstrong. Dan Armstrong.
Yeah.
How many bases
you can see
you got?
Your junk and still play? About 10.
I'm sorry, I laughed at the joke. How many?
10 bases.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's at least 10 guitars around here at some point. Who's the good bass player for Level 42? That guy has that fucker slapped way up here. That 80s band, do you even know them?
I don't remember them, no. You stumped me, it's obscure.
Go. All right, so we got 2 bass guitars, or 5 perfect ratings, I guess, so far. That's all I'm trying to get at there. The next song, Outshine.
terrible song.
No, of course, this song fucking sucks.
This sucks. No, this is the perfect 1-2 punch. Oh, you can't get a better 1-2 punch than Rusty Cage and Outshine. In fact, if they would have had nothing on the rest of the album and released a 2-song single, it would still be number 2 on this this list to me. Yeah.
It is so fucking good. And one of those classic drop D riffs. I mean, that's that boom, boom,
boom, boom. Everybody ripped this off. Every band after this from the 90s pretty much rips this off going forward.
I watched the video today. Still holds up. They got the new HD version of it. I thought it was going to be more of a kind of a time capsule. That's how my memory was for it. But it's actually pretty badass looking still. But, I mean, this song helps. I mean, and it's such a cool standout track. It just, it's like they're not really doing anything new or different, but this was one of the most unique sounding singles of this era. I mean, just that "Show Me the Power, Child," that just, it just drives, and it's just, there's so many little accent-y guitar pieces that's going on pretty much through this whole album, I'll just say. But yeah, and of course, we talk about Cornell. Jesus fucking Christ, he just delivers. This might be my favorite. If I did a top 100 grunge songs, this might be number one for me. I haven't put any thought into it, but this is just so fucking good. It's so much better than almost anything out there.
And I would, I totally agree with you. And I would say that this song set the stage for the rest of their career. To me, this made such a statement of who Soundgarden is. If you listen to everything before this, it doesn't equate to who Soundgarden are after this. Song says, "This is us."
I wonder if, because Rusty Cage is a bit of a weird song, I wonder if that would have been embraced as much if this wasn't the first song. You know what I mean? It's still a killer tune. It is just a little bit different, you know? I don't know. You remember Headbangers Ball was kind of making a shift to bring some of the stuff in around this time.
Well, I was going to say this, it's a perfect blend because it's huge metallic hooks, but you got these pop sensibilities in the choruses, you know?
It's weird.
Yeah, but at the same time, it is the thing that not only set the stage for them, but to me kind of set the stage for all of these grunge bands that would come after them of we can play metal, but we can do it this way where it's got a little bit of punk rock to it, but it's also very accessible from a chorus standpoint. But,
yeah. Outshine, I think, was the beginning of it. It was after Andy had died and Temple of the Dog had already been written and recorded. It was literally like the period that I was writing the lyrics was literally like 2 days before Desert Shield turned into Desert Storm. And personally, too, I was just getting a little bit sick of just kind of avoiding certain aspects of lyric writing, some of which was maybe I didn't want to get too personal because I didn't think anybody would care, and because it would annoy me sometimes when I would hear other people sing about their lives too personally. I'd be like, why would I care, you know? Fuck off, that kind of thing. Yeah. And the other aspect was, look, there's like 3 other members in my band that have to get up here and play this, and it has to somehow kind of relate to them. And I just kind of, in Outshine, there's a little bit of, it was almost like I imagined myself singing that song to this guy who's my friend that's now in heaven, kind of looking down on me and being like, you know, what the hell am I going to do now? And just opening up that much in that lyric and letting it go was kind of the beginning of that feeling.
I wonder what it was like. I heard Chris Cornell talk about this, and they weren't sure this was going to make the album when they recorded it. And I'm like, is anybody listening and going, this
no
is not
shit.
Good? How do you fucking record this song in the studio and go, it's all right. Maybe it's a B-side. We'll see. When we're all done, maybe we'll keep this. It's like, fuck you. What do you want? The ball left the park. It's a home run.
Yeah. Take this your seems four quite bases. Obvious.
Jesus.
How about the breakdown? Because that's another thing that they do perfectly, and it's another thing that so many people imitate. especially after this came out. So many people imitated that bridge.
And it comes right back into that, so now you know. And even that little line in the way they sing, it's just delivered, is like, so now you know. It's like, it draws you in, but it's like, it's so simple, but nobody did it. It's like, well, this is very fucking cool, man.
Agreed. I can't say much about this.
What's the rating? I'm perfect. Guessing this is going to get somewhere between a 3 and a 5.
Yeah, so this is 5. So what is to come? That's what this gets.
Okay, I get. I'll match your 5. This is 5. So what is to come is from Baco too. All right, the next track, "Slaves and Bulldozers."
"Slaves and Bulldozers" mm-hmm. is my favorite song on the record.
I hear it is a little bit of a step back into that territory of where they were in Louder Than Love, a little bit. But it's very Sabbath-y to me. A lot of Iommi kind of tones, and I mean, my God, here's Cornell again. He's proving himself to be the supreme being. I mean, just nailing it. I will say though, as cool as the tones are, and as cool as his vocals are, I'm not a huge fan of the guitar solo.
I would think this would be funner if you saw them play it live in a club than, say, at an arena or like a festival or something like that. I can see you really getting into that vibe and that kind of tight, kind of sweaty, you know, where you just see that band. And that might be the best way to see these guys, too, by the way, that just in a smaller stage where they're just destroying it.
I also think there's kind of an energy that happens in theaters that doesn't happen in arenas that kind of fits almost best for us. Like, we learned early on that we could handle a really big stage inside, outside, and it was kind of great, and we were sort of suited for it. But on the other hand, our music is kind of dark, and there's a sort of dark intimacy that works really well in smaller places. And so it was kind of the decision to, like, let's take this tour and this new album out to places where it's not like a come one, come all sort of feeding frenzy, but focus on the hardcore fans that have been following us all this time.
But I do like the cool breakdown in the song. Here again, they have another cool breakdown.
A lot of that on this record, but yeah, they got "No More Rats for Free." Just another that rangy Chris Cornell right there. You know, I mean,
yeah. So you got a 1-2-3 punch with this one. You know, usually you get a 1-2 punch at best. Now you got a 1-2-3 punch.
I'm gonna say this is 1-2 and yeah punch.
Okay.
Yeah, they slow down a little bit here as far as that. Like I said, I still like the record. But I can't step on your rating. It's your rating call. What are we doing here?
Yeah, so I'm going to take it down one notch. So this is going to get 4 dirty spark plugs.
This gets 3.5 dirty spark plugs for me. So a little less for me. But the next song, "Jesus Christ Pose." I will tell you, this one was a bit of a grower for me, but of course.
Jesus Christ pose. Arms out.
What can you say about this fucking tune?
You can say it's almost fucking perfect is what you can say. I mean, this is the one I just wrote in big marker. Matt Cameron is killing it.
Oh,
he
yeah.
He just kills it on this one.
Yeah. He's almost like a Matt Cameron solo song.
Oh, and this is where, to me, this is where he set the stage for all those groups that would follow this band afterwards and try to mimic what he's doing and add that whole tribal thing that so many bands did in the 90s. But none to the perfection that he gets here.
Agreed. And that off key kind of spastic guitar harmony that's repeating over and over in the intro, though. The reason this was a grower for me is that was kind of like, I don't know, it's kind of grindy and harsh to listen to. But once you kind of get the vibe,
almost
of the
industrial.
Song, yeah. Yeah. Exactly. It's very much that. But. I think once I got over kind of that and started realizing how it fit perfectly into the song, that's when I started to like get into that more of the whole vibe of everything. But even like those tribal drums when they shift to that, like I'm driving the nails, that little part, man, it's just Cameron is just, again, I can't say enough gushy things about the guy. But at this point, we are really seeing the prog that you've been talking about. This is yeah. more than the three previous songs. This is a very prog. Proggy tune.
Probably why I love it so much. I'm glad you said that because I wrote in my notes, I love the bridge with the full horn vocals, which is another thing that every band tried to do after this, to have a bullhorn on there. And then I wrote, in, again, big capital letters, proggy riffing. Love it.
Had to be fun to be a member of this band at this time because they were doing so many things. Four tracks in there, just all over the fucking place, but everything still sounds tight. It's a cohesive record still.
Yeah.
It's just.
Yeah, and more vocal acrobatics from Cornell. He's not letting up, man. He's just killing it.
And stare at me. God, one of a kind. This is probably him really pushing it almost through the entire song.
Now, have you ever watched them play this song as far as like watched what they're doing on the guitar? Because I actually am trying to understand how they're doing the droney guitar thing. Because if you listen to that low note, it sounds like it's being barely strummed with a thumb or something. I'm not exactly sure.
I've not broken it down to that level, but it is so layered and it is. There's only a couple spots where the actual riff can, you know, be where you would say, this is the build up is all kind of like noise and kind of like it's just so experimental in what they're doing and I can't imagine. I bet you they've probably at times rehearsed in this song. They played it for a half hour. I mean, just
it just jammed on it. I remember reading something with Kim at some point. I don't know if it was this record or the next one, but he was talking about a song and he said, you know how I got that tone? I put the guitar on the table and I blew on the strings. And I'm like, who does that? Who records that?
And he was using those PV VTM 60s that Michael Beinhorn despised. with good reason. It's like, come on, you can afford a better amp now. I mean,
the tones are killer, man. The tones are amazing on this thing.
Yeah, so it really. I think it was a lot of work getting a good tone out of his rig, if that's what he was really using. But
yeah, you got to make them.
I had two of them. You know, I'm very familiar with that amp, and they're very much the perfect kind of like low budget. It'll give you a powerful head with a half stack without dropping $2,000. You know what I mean? But once you kind of get to this level, you probably should upgrade a little bit. But anyway.
Yep.
What's our rating?
Our rating is going to be 5 pairs of long johns and jean shorts.
I'm going to cut it back just a little bit. I love this tune, but it's 4.5 pairs of long johns and jean shorts.
Why was that a fashion thing? I don't get it. But
well,
it
I think it's Seattle. The ripped jeans has always looked cool, but now you're like also like, well, but it's also kind of chilly outside, guys. So,
right. So I'm going to wear the long johns.
And then like, hey, you know, why don't I just make these fucking shorts?
Yeah. Jorts.
The Canadian tuxedo. Up next is Face Pollution. We'll be right back.
I love the, and I'm going to say this, it's a very Yes-y, proggy instrumental bridge on this song. If you listen to the little instrumental bridge on this song and go listen to Yes from the 80s that had Trevor Rabin as the guitarist, it almost sounds like something Trevor Rabin would have done.
Man, as a guy who's from a punk band, I wrote down once they go prog, then they go punk. To me, this is very much a punk tune, man.
Yeah, no, I agree with you until that weird little instrumental bridgey thing.
You were very specific, so I'm not gonna debate you on that. I think you might. I'm not familiar with the comparison you're making, so.
All right.
Again, you're bringing the obscuria. That's the genius that you have today. I don't know. It's just not a standout track to me by any means. It's okay.
Yeah, I was going to say my attention for the first time in this record, my attention fades slightly. Even though it still has that Jimmy Page kind of feel on the chorus, and you know, very much a mix of 70s with punk, but. Yeah, I'm the same way. This is the first time listening. And part of it, and the rest of the album is going to suffer just a little bit because the first couple of songs are so strong that it's you almost want to go back and listen to those songs again every time I hear this album.
Yeah, there's plenty of times that's what happened to me. I would get to Jesus Christ Pose and start over, you know.
Exactly, yeah. And so when I was going back and listening to this album, I realized that very rarely did I make it to the end of this thing because it was so strong in the beginning that I would go do that. I would go back to the beginning. And there are songs that I listened to in preparation for this. I was like, this is not as much in my memory as those other songs that are on the first side. And the reason is because of that. They're so strong.
There was only one track that was the case for me. Well, I shouldn't say that. Some of them definitely aren't as ingrained as Outshined or Rusty Cage. But there is one track in particular on the other side of this album that I remember thinking, like, I remember why I kind of forget this one. And, you know, I saw the title. I'm like, I don't remember how that one goes, that kind of deal. This one, I remembered how it went. But I don't know, listening back to it, it didn't do much to change my mind. What do we have for a rating for Face Pollution?
Yeah, so I'm going to do this one, 3 infected nose rings.
I also have 3 infected nose rings, so we are pretty close on this thing all the way through. Well, side one of the cassette. I don't remember if this came out on vinyl initially, but we're going to go with the cassette because they were still popular in 91. Yep. Side one ends with Somewhere. I wish to wish I dreamed a dream I tried.
And I would say this to me is taking it back up a notch from the previous song. I think the weird thing here to me is that the verse is almost hookier than the chorus in this case.
Absolutely. I had something very similar written down.
Yeah. It's which is you wouldn't think that would be the case, but that's the case here. And then the chorus, while it's not as hooky, it's still very Soundgarden, and it's very what you're going to get from Soundgarden the rest of their career out of this. And I would say that, to me, this is a standout track for Ben Shepherd. I think the bass on this song is just incredible.
I adore the vocal. I think it's one of the best recorded vocals on the record. But I really love that part where, like, I wish to wish, the kind of thing. But then he does that thing where he loves to amp up. It's like... And I just, and the thing is, every time I hear this song, I know that's coming, and I'm just sitting there going, come on, come on.
Waiting
I,
for it, waiting
yeah,
for it, yeah.
It's just like, so, this song is and again, it's, what a great way to, I mean, so far we really don't have a lot of misses, and this is definitely not one. What about a rating?
I'm going to give this 4 extra large paper thin tour shirts. And and I don't know if you remember, but the tour shirts you bought in the 90s at these shows were super thin, the poorest quality shit you could get. And for whatever reason, I'm at best a medium. And I would buy an XL. All through the 90s, I wore XL. So the seam for my sleeve would be halfway down my arm.
Looking
that
cool.
That was a thing. That
look
cool.
I'll give this 5 extra large super thin concert t-shirts. This is almost a perfect song for me. And again, it kind of makes you not want to go to side 2, go back and listen to side 1 right now, but I don't know.
Which is what happened a lot of times.
Yeah. I did end up getting into where most of this album it was so important, especially once I was listening to the CD, then it would just kind of keep going. But I did have the cassette for a while. But
that's what I started on, too. We had the cassette tape.
Before we get into side 2, as I'm want to do, I like to ask a handful of kind of standard questions, kind of get a read on where my guest was, get kind of different insight to the whole scene, all that stuff. So you already told me you were a freshman in college in 1991. Well, so Nevermind comes out, and then, you know, it does hit pretty quick, and things changed pretty fast. Where were you musically, we'll just say before Nevermind, what were you listening to leading up to this?
Yeah, so I remember this very vividly, freshman year. So this came out in September, correct? And so did Nevermind. So I remember in August moving in freshman year, and at that time I had just bought the Black Eyed Susan cassette tape, if you remember that band.
I do. Dizzy Dean.
Dizzy Dean, yes.
That's
it was Britney
Fox. That's a solid album.
It is solid. It was their attempt to try to mimic the Black Crowes, but you know, it didn't quite work out for them. but I remember that I had just gotten that, and we're moving into the dorm, and I'm playing that, and I think a lot of folks at that time were playing Razor's Edge. That was a big album that
AC/DC.
That fall is that fall as well. So
that's when Duck vocals started. I don't understand what people were hearing. I don't know.
Not a huge fan of that album, but that's what was being played, and so everybody in our dorm room. And we had paper thin walls. This is in Clemson, South Carolina, in some dorms that were built to be temporary back in the 40s that were still standing in the 90s. So you can imagine. So anyway, you know, we're hearing everybody's music, and everybody, for the most part, if they're not playing what we used to call college rock, right, which became alternative, but if they're not playing some college rock, then they're mostly playing hair bands. And by the middle of that semester after Nirvana came out, I would say everything, you're right, everything changed. And you no longer heard, you know, I blasted Black Eyed Susan and no one thought it was cool anymore.
That small window when Black Eyed Susan was the fucking closer in the panty dropping room, all right?
That was the shit. No, I don't think anyone ever got that one. But, you know, I was diving into, because I was big into Living Color and 24/7 Spies, and you know, Chili Peppers were releasing their new album as well. So I was way into funk, rock, funk, metal at the same time too. But yeah, when that
Fishbone
dropped, man, Fishbone, love Fishbone, man. Seen them several times. One of my favorite bands of all time. Yeah, I was rocking all that. But that drops, and everybody, I swear, everybody on my floor, all of a sudden, all you're hearing is Soundgarden, Nirvana. I even remember hearing Mother Love Bone for the first time. Mm. Everybody just picked it up immediately.
And it even fashion changed. You know what I mean? Like, girls stopped dressing slutty. I mean,
I know, right? Good point, man. Yeah, all of a sudden they're wearing the same shoes that I'm wearing. Like, why are you wearing Doc Martens? That's not cool on a chick.
I have no idea if you have big tits or not with that flannel shirt on. That's way too
right.
big. You know, it's
well, it was funny because do
which
you
was
remember
important
that
then.
It's still important. Do you remember the there was a little fad, especially with bands, I don't know about in the Minnesota area, but there was a little fad where bands coming out of the 80s and early 90s, they were trying to be kind of Lenny Kravitz-esque, where they were trying to dress kind of 60s-ish.
I know what you're talking about, yeah.
You know, kind of flowery, paisley and
not
stuff
everybody,
like that.
Not everybody, but there's definitely, you know, there's, I know what you're saying, yeah.
Yeah, it was kind of a thing. And then, of course, grunge comes in and just kicks that all away, you know. And like, you know, the guy that had on the paisley shirt one week, the next week he had on a nice flannel.
Yeah, yeah. What about you? What did you think when you, did you buy into grunge pretty quick once it became kind of an undeniable movement?
Yeah, I was in right away. But again, for me, I was always, I wasn't so much a trend follower. I just wanted to consume everything. So while I'm discovering grunge, I'm also discovering jazz for the first time. I'm also discovering progressive rock from the 1970s. What a fucking weirdo I am. But, you know, I'm diving into all this stuff at the same time, and I'm really getting into everything. And it speaks to why I do what I do now with our show, because I just enjoy music in general. If it has a guitar on it, for the most part, I'm probably going to like it. So that in that time especially, it was just all about discovery. It was, even the classic rock bands that I hadn't heard, I was just diving in as much as I could. But I was way into grunge for sure.
And well, I'm guessing the answer's kind of obvious because you almost explained it with that answer there. But what do you think now when you look back at grunge?
I have so enjoyed listening to your episodes because it's brought back some memories for me. But I've always listened to it, but I would say I kind of dropped some of those records, you know, ones that I just wore out in the 90s. I probably dropped a few of them and didn't really dive back in until I started listening to this podcast. Aww. Again. Like I hadn't listened to L7 in years, and I put Bricks Are Heavy on after I heard your episode. Because we had done one song, and I did a grunge episode too after you started. And I'm like, oh, that's why I reached out to you.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I was like, that's not that unique of an idea. I think you're okay. Yeah.
I felt like, oh, shit, he's going to think I'm following his trend or something. But
no, you definitely do your own show, so I wasn't too worried about it.
But there's certain bands that, you know, you've reminded me of that I need to go back into. And when you take an album, you break it down, it really makes you want to go and dive into it. So this has been a lot of fun, dude.
I really appreciate that. It's been very rewarding on a lot of levels, just to share a little bit with you. I mean, on a personal level, I've cut a vein a handful of times about, you know, it kind of took me back to this time and where I was as a person and a lot of the growth that's happened since then. I've kind of looked back, you know, and I can kind of see, this music was very important. Music has always been important to me, but you know, it was like Kiss, hair metal, and then grunge. And at very key moments in my life, really helped kind of like get me through things that maybe weren't going great. So that's been kind of fun to kind of look back and go, hey, you know what? You did okay. You know what I mean? You weren't perfect, but also just the feedback from people like you, it really has made it easy to keep going. But I think the biggest compliment I can pay to the people who have hung in there and listened to this is that, like, I don't know if I did a hair metal version of this, if I would have people that would be okay. Like you mentioned the L7. I didn't have a very positive review of that record, but I didn't really hear not every record of I loved, but yet people hang in there and go, well, it wasn't your thing. I think if I did hair metal and I'm getting to like some like Pretty Boy Floyd record, people are like, you know, what the fuck's wrong with this idiot? You know what I mean? I think grunge, at least the audience seems to be like, eh, whatever, this is still fun. He fucking talked about the whole album and, you know, whatever.
I was going to say, what comments did you get from the whole album? Because I fucking hate that album. There's nothing redeeming about that to me.
Nothing negative, honestly. Actually, I got like, you know what? You guys were pretty fair, and neither one of us liked the damn record. And the feedback I got was like, well, you know, I mean, you kind of joked around. You had some misogynistic fun, but at the same time, you addressed the important issues that she was talking about lyrically. I thought the feedback seemed to be that, like, is hard to believe, especially with Ian Wadley as a guest. We were fairly fair and balanced.
One of the biggest shows that I've ever played is my second show with the Swears, we played a thing here in Atlanta called Music Midtown, which back in the day, it was a 3-day event, big festival, kind of like Lollapalooza, where they basically have stages that are owned by different radio stations. And, you know, one band plays on a big stage and then the people basically turn around and watch the next band on the other big stage. And so we went opposite our good buddy from Hole. So that was interesting.
I've only seen that band once, and it was at a radio station 2-day festival on Memorial Weekend. And Courtney lost her shit and was swearing at the audience. And I think I'd remember the show at all if she didn't do it.
Yeah, I think that was her stick because she did the same thing. She got all whiny and bitchy, and to play a stage that size and then realize who's coming on next. You know, the fact that she didn't maybe shut us down early or something, that I consider that a win.
I have accepted that I may have not have given her a fair break, like because of who she was married to, the timing, her just personality in general. So she's probably more talented, more important than I want to give her credit for. But I don't know. It's just not my thing. They were supposed to open for Marilyn Manson on a tour, and she dropped out for some reason, and we got Nashville Pussy, and that was a big win for me. So.
Which, did you know they're from Atlanta?
Nashville Pussy?
Yeah.
I did not, no.
I didn't either until we did a show a few weeks ago, and I was reading off Atlanta bands, and that was one that came up from Atlanta. I had never heard that. I didn't even know they were from my town.
No, I think Cherokee Parks' sister was still... The Cherokee Parks is a basketball player. He played in North Carolina, and then for the Timberwolves here in Minnesota. His sister was the 6'7" Amazon bass player for them for a long time. But I think she was still in the band when I saw them, because she was out not long after, if not. But it's still mainly, they're still active, right? It's the writer and the dude, right?
Yeah, as far as I know, they're still active, and who knows what's going on right now, but.
All right. Well, here is the question everybody wants to get into, because it's stupid and pointless, but it's a lot of fun to talk about. Did grunge kill hair metal?
No. No, it did not. Because my answer here, I think a lot of people have said it, but I mean, music in general and trends are cyclical. And to me, a lot of that aligns with the decades usually. And the decade of the 80s was done. And the main trend coming out of the 80s as hair metal was also done, and people were ready to move on to something different. And I think no matter what, that was going to happen, no matter if grunge was the next thing or whatever it was going to be. I think that still to this day happens, although not quite as much as it used to, because
I think really isn't trends anymore. Now it's just like this blender of music. You just pour into a cup and it's like, this is kind of everything.
Yeah, but you can clearly, at least through the 2000s, probably 2000 was the last time, but you can clearly see the 60s, when the 70s came, everything changed. Yeah. When the 70s ended, all those bands that were huge at the end of the 70s kind of went away. You had your 80s bands, same thing in the 90s.
And hair metal actually had a really good run when you look at how long it lasted, from like inception to where, you know, basically it didn't die really until about 91. And it was, you know, riding high in 83. That's a good 8-year stretch there. Where grunge, basically 3 years, man.
Yeah, it was a quick burn for grunge.
Well, everybody died.
this is true. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's get to side two. The cassette is fully fast forwarded. Although I wonder which side is longer. I don't know. We can't remember. Side two opens up with Searching With My Good Eye Closed.
Intro to this song. Do you remember where that came from? I'm sure you.
Oh, the little wind-up toy that
The little wind-up thing. Yeah, I think people now would have no idea.
Yeah. I didn't know where you were going with that, because I wrote down like one of the longest fade-ins I can ever think of. This is almost a minute and a half before the fade is done. But yeah, you're talking about the little sound where it's like,
this toy is a pig.
Yeah, it's like, describe the toy.
Yeah, so for people that don't know, there was a preschool toy when we were kids.
One of my favorites, by the way. I love this fucking toy.
I do too. And it was basically, I think it was kind of round, and it had a big dial on it with an arrow, right? Yep. And then around the dial were pictures of animals. And you would turn the dial, and then I think you would pull a
little zip string.
You would pull a little zip string, yeah. And then it would turn, and wherever your arrow was, it would say, the cow, whatever the animal is, it would say, the cow makes this noise, and it would make the noise. And so when I heard that the first time, I was like, I know, I remember what that was. But I would imagine that kids or anybody that's younger than us may have no clue what that is. But
I took it for granted. I'm glad you brought that up. I wasn't even going to talk about that. But yeah, people our age that were 20 when this record came out, probably all like, oh, that's what that is. That's kind of cool. But if you hear
it, we all had one.
Yeah.
Fisher Price, man. But I always love that. And I love the... you know, just the way that they come, it has a little tongue in cheek. It's, you know, got a little humor in it. Let's have this band that can be super serious, but they're not taking themselves too seriously.
Right.
I love that. And this is another song for me that clearly shows the direction that they're going to take the rest of their career. It's another one of those staples to me. I absolutely love this song. And when I saw them play it live, it translates live. This is an amazing live song from them.
That is a great point. This is probably the one track that would fit on Super Unknown better than any other song on here.
Yeah, this is them saying, this is who we are, this is who we're going to be, and we're going to make a whole lot of money doing this.
Yeah.
You know? So I don't think I mentioned that I saw Soundgarden when I saw them. Nope. So you saw them more recently before Chris
Yeah, a few days
away,
before
right?
he died. They played a festival here in, actually in Wisconsin, but anyway.
Yeah, so I saw them back in the day, and I was trying to remember exactly when. So I used to put my tickets in my CDs, right? So
that.
that's how I'd keep my stub. So it's in my Down on the Upside CD, and I saw them on the Down on the Upside tour, and this was a really fantastic show because if you remember in '96, the Olympics were in Atlanta, and I had just moved to Atlanta right when the Olympics started. And Soundgarden puts on a show. I think it's the first weekend of the Olympics. And there's a place in Atlanta
Was it part of the Olympic presentation or just a timing thing?
Nope, just a timing thing. Okay. And there's it's kind of like a mall, but it's in downtown Atlanta, or it used to be. And it's called Underground Atlanta. And basically, it's a mall that's underground. And you enter, and it looks like it's one story. And then you go underground, and it's like a mall with a couple levels. And Soundgarden, they had them set up. It's the only band that I've ever seen do this. They had the band set up on top of the entrance. So it's basically the roof of this place called Underground Atlanta, which is just a badass setup. And they put chain link fence around the streets surrounding this place. And that's basically that was your concert venue. Well, the thing that they got wrong, so everything's great, right? Sounds great with what they're doing. But the thing that they got wrong was they put and let me see if it's on the ticket. It says right here, 6 p.m. That's when they're supposed to go on. It's Atlanta, Georgia in July, and it's hot as hell. And we have people from all over the world.
6 p.m. is like
that's
that time where it's the hottest part of the day.
Yeah, yeah. And we've got people from all over the world who aren't used to the heat. And you're telling people on a ticket that they're going on at 6. And this is not a opener, you know, couple openers and then Soundgarden. No, this is just a Soundgarden show.
Oh, really? Okay, I get you.
And so Soundgarden doesn't go on until close to 10 o'clock. And even after dark in Atlanta in July, it's fucking hot, man. Yeah. So I have never seen, and we were packed in like sardines. I mean, everybody in the world is in Atlanta at this time. So everybody's at this show. And I have never seen so many fights before a show as at this place, just because people are so hot and miserable. I mean, it was like all you could do to just duck from the fight that was over to your right and the fight that was over to your left.
You got
to
go see Jackal at Bratfest in Wisconsin. That's where the fights go.
Well, I was going to say, I'm a punk rock kid, man. I used to go to, you know, see punk rock shows. And I was like, holy shit, this is bad. Yeah. So that was my Soundgarden experience, but they killed it live. You know, if you could just duck and not get hit and swung at, you were good.
Walking around Atlanta, how often do you run into Jermaine Dupri?
Yeah, about every day.
Yeah, up here in the Twin Cities, it's Cisco.
Thong, 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 thong.
So we got Cisco.
Yeah, I don't walk anywhere now. I'm in the burbs.
Oh, listen to you, hot stuff. All right. Well, so Cisco, yeah, he lives in Maple Grove. See him at Dave and Buster's every Tuesday.
Thong, thong, all right. Thong, thong.
I love this track. Is it about skydiving? It's got that opening line, painted blue across my sky, strap the linen on.
I never drew that from this, but yeah, it sounds totally valid. I never got that.
One thing I wanted to mention with this track is that so many of these songs, as I would like, this record just would get played and played. Suddenly, this is my favorite fucking Soundgarden song. And this is definitely one of them where it like moved and like now I have to hear this all over and over again. I just remember my roommate and I, you know, I don't know, doing whatever kind of bullshit we could do with no money at home. You know, getting drunk and listening to music and playing Tecmo Bowl. This would be a song I would repeat. But
yeah, if you would taken this song and put it where Face Pollution is, can you imagine how powerful Side One would have been?
But you lose this amazing opener to Side Two.
That's true, but Side One would have just been the shit.
Fuck. Yeah, maybe it was. Maybe that should have just be done. What do we have for a rating, man?
So this one's going to get five Screaming Devils.
Ooh, nice. I give it 5 Screaming Devils, too. Well, the next track up here is we're talking about Room 1,000 Years Wide.
So this song has one main problem. I love parts of this song. I think the Matt Cameron time signature awesomeness is just incredible what he's doing in this song.
Oh, he is just nuts on here.
I mean, try to count it. Go ahead. the riff is, to me, very Alice in Chains-y. I get a real Alice in Chains vibe on this song for some reason.
All right, I can see that.
And then you've got two things that kill this for me. You've got this droney siren guitar that annoys the shit out of me. I want it to stop and it doesn't stop. It just keeps going on and on. If they would have mixed it, you know, a few dBs lower, I may have been fine with it. And fair then enough. You throw in a very unnecessary sax solo in the end.
It's weird. This is one of the few times that like a sax on a record like this doesn't just immediately annoy the shit out of me. But yeah, not my favorite track, but not my least favorite tune on here at all. That whole annoying little guitar thing, I do think probably could be lowered in the mix a little bit. The song doesn't annoy me that much, so I do like it. But again, we're kind of in prog zone. But this goes back to showing Cornell that he could write God damn near a melody, almost any kind of thing. It's just
he can write a melody that's amazing that can be sung by anyone around a very odd time signature, very odd prog thing.
It is.
I'm not saying that anybody can sing it, but you can hum to it at least.
Well, let's not keep the listeners waiting. What's your rating here?
This gets 2 annoying bees for me.
Oh wow, I have nothing that goes that low. This actually, believe it or not, I gave this 4. What did you say, queen bees?
Annoying bees.
Four annoying bees. This is what it gets for me.
Is that a bee note
that he's hitting on that?
Maybe.
Or it just sounds like a bee, you're saying. Okay.
It just sounds like a bee. Yeah,
that was similar to how I felt about that little on Jesus Christ Pose, but that kind of
over and over.
What's that?
I said that one doesn't repeat over and over and over.
That's all it does for the first minute of the song. It's like,
I guess.
That one I kind of grew into more once I saw the bigger picture. It seemed like this did not click with me. I agree with you as far as that, but I still, man, Cornell I think saves the song. Well, as does Cameron. He's just fucking crazy in this tune. But all right, that brings us to Mind Riot.
I mean, vocal acrobatics, and you won't get this again. This is the last time you're going to get this.
Pretty much.
You won't do it on other albums. I like the tribal drumming here again. I feel like in the grand scheme of this album, this would have fit on the next album or possibly on a soundtrack. My personal opinion is this should have been left as a B-side.
Yeah, I mean this record is long enough that you probably could have taken if you want to cherry pick a tune out, you certainly could. That opening riff, you hear like a low bass playing at the very beginning, but then that to me that sounds like a bass playing on top of a bass. I've never really heard a band do that, and I don't know that that's what they're doing. It could just be how they're EQing or sounding it. You didn't, okay. So
yeah, we multi-track basses.
But like with different, like kind of like almost rhythmic parts or.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Fair enough. I don't know. You're the bass player. Is that what it sounds like to you when it comes in with that boom, ba-da-da-doom? To me, that's bass.
What it sounds like to me. Okay. Or it could be like a bass six, you know, with that crazy Fender guitar. That's played like a guitar, but it's a bass.
Okay,
I guess actually, but this, yeah, it kind of sounds like a little trick bass or maybe even a baritone.
But it's just a cool little chill little riff, kind of gets you into the thing. But yeah, this is the line. This is the song with the line where the candles burned out yesterday. Somebody's best friend died, and they call it a mind riot. That's basically the entire chorus. But I love the way he sings that. I just candles burned out yesterday. Kind of does that kind of where he kind of gets a little lower, but still kind of got that power.
Yeah, he's pretty much in that upper register the whole time. I don't know how the man does it or did it. It was just impressive.
It's clear at this point that Matt Cameron does think he's in Yes. Or King, or you a better example you have
he's
is
in King Crimson, King, yeah.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, he thinks he's Bill Bruford. Yep.
his eyes, like when he sees Kim Thayil, he sees Robert Fripp.
He's Carl Palmer. We'll go to even crazier.
Well, clearly not your go-to track on this record. What do you give it for a rating?
Yeah, so I'm going to give this 3 should have been on the single soundtracks. Single soundtrack, sorry.
Yeah, you know what? I'll I'm not a big fan of that soundtrack. I think it's overrated. Mind Riot to me though, it gives 4 should have been on the single soundtrack. Still think it's okay. I'm still vibing this album, man.
Oh, I'm loving the album, but again, I said it earlier, it's just so heavy hitting up front. It's so front loaded to me that
so everything just, you're doing, people need to keep in mind then is that you're rating this is compared to Outshined.
Yeah, I'm comparing everything to the beginning of the album.
Okay, yeah. To me, then this is probably a 1. If I have to do that, I'm giving it its own little spot on this album and then where it fits. But up next is Drawing Flies.
Sitting here like I'm in my company.
this is where the sax kind of like goes, maybe you didn't need it here.
I feel like this is, I mean, I sort of like it in a way. I think it's an odd choice again for this album, given, you know, the fact that I'm basing everything on how strong the beginning of the album is. And it's almost a little ultra mega-ish. A little bit good, to me.
Yeah, a little bit.
It would have fit in that time frame. I love the change up, but it still comes across to me that this might be the one piece of filler here on this album.
Ooh, I wouldn't go that far. I do love that the doon de dee loon de dee. Again, Cameron is killing it here, but sitting here in the just that melody that they had going on there, it's the sax that really ruins this one for me.
And maybe that's what it is for me too. It just, like I said, it feels like them maybe doing something they'd done before.
Yeah, and it really is kind of a abrasive sax too. It's like it's kind of violent, and maybe that's what they wanted to. The song's called "Fucking Drawing Flies," and then I immediately think of cat turds. anyway, what do we have for a rating on "Drawing Flies"? It doesn't sound like, unless you have more, but it doesn't sound like we want to elaborate much more.
I don't really have. The only other thing I wanted to say is it is quick. It ends before it really gets established.
I did want to say that bass breakdown at that, where it's just the bass, drums, and vocal doom is kind of badass right after the fucking sax solo.
You can't deny it. Yeah, I mean, the Shepherd and Cameron, I mean, just phew, they're just firing, man. They clicked right away, I'm assuming.
Yeah, it had to be easy.
I'm gonna give this 2.5 free BMG CDs.
Can I give it 4 Columbia House CDs I didn't pay for?
Sure.
I feel like we're not giving them the proper respect of CD theft. all right, well, the next track, Holy Water, maybe this one perks you up a little bit.
Absolutely perks me up. This is we're back. We're firing again. This is a great riff, great Cornell vocals. I love this chorus. This is one of the best choruses on this album. It is so powerful. And then you got this amazing nod to Hendrix lead backwards kind of thing going on.
Oh, I didn't even pick up on that. That's brilliant.
It's short and to the point, but it's so reminiscent of a Hendrix style riff or Hendrix style lead. And then this is the one that I wrote the third verse. The riff is so King Crimson. This is so Robert Fripp to me.
Okay. It's funny that you said it's short, because I wrote down, this is the fastest 5-minute song I've ever heard. It does not feel 5 minutes long at all. It feels like a 3.5 minute track.
No, the lead is short. The guitar lead is short.
Oh, okay.
That's what
I thought we had something, but I guess not.
Great outro on this song too. Amazing. Just they're so great about you know, bringing in almost like a symphony where they bring in parts, and I guess that's a nod to their proggy thing again, but they have intros and outros, and not every band was doing that.
No, definitely not. I love that line, "Holy water is rusting me." It's just a brilliant lyric. And then of course the way he fucking sings it just it's like
Oh,
God.
just holds it out forever and just nails it. Oh my God, the guy was amazing.
And on the second chorus, let's give a little more blow to Matt Cameron here. He play on the second chorus. I didn't hear it on the first one. He plays the first half of the second chorus pretty straight, and then almost goes halftime on the second half of it. And it, you don't even know really what's going on. But I'm like, I think when he gets bored, he just has to come up with a drum part to keep things interesting for him, so he doesn't get distracted. Like, you know, because, you know, drummers are pretty simple guys.
They are. He goes into his "What would Bill Bruford do?" mode.
Never heard that name before until today, and now it's going to be a thing.
I bet you will never hear it again on Cobras and Fire.
I bet I'll never hear it again. Unless I'm hanging out with Cisco. Oh, man. So Holy Water, let's give it a rating, man.
This is I'm going to tie this to the concert that I saw, because they played this song. So this is going to get five.
Damn.
This is going to get five pre-show fights.
I also gave it five pre-show fights. I kind of want to go to Atlanta now. Well, here we are with the record closes out with this is the one track that, like, when I was looking at I was like, I just couldn't remember how it went looking at the song title, and the album closes with New Damage.
This is very Skin Yard to me.
Oh, wow.
This comes across very Skin Yard. And I know those bands were tight, so I don't know if that was on purpose or if it just reminds me of something they would have done. But that was the first thing. And that's, you know, the other thing I wrote is this is pure sludge. This is them doing just a sludgy, when you think of grunge and the tone and what was coming across from a, you know, a Sonics perspective, this is that sludgy song. And I used to make mixtapes back in the day for my friends because I had so much weird music. And I remember
lady friends.
I wish. No, it's mostly dudes. Ladies didn't want to listen to what I was listening to, unfortunately.
Yeah, I found that out too.
Yeah. So, but I do remember putting together a collection of grunge tapes for people, and I would call them muck instead of grunge. I call them muck.
So you're so like, what do you think tonight there, hot girl, salty dog, or black-eyed Susan?
you know that I know who Dizzy Dean is?
I'm sorry.
No worries.
Carry on.
No, I was just going to say, so I would put this song on that, I remember on one of the mixtapes called Muck. This to me fits that title of muck. This is just a sludgy tune. The riff in the chorus is fantastic. And I wrote here, so see what you think. But other than Skin Yard, the other thing that came across to me is a very Rollins-esque last half of End of Silence. If you go back to End of Silence album, Rollins band, this song kind of fits that mold as well.
I don't know that band enough to comment on that. So.
Really? That was another one. That was at the same time. That was another one of the albums that we were rocking out, at least in our dorm room, with this album.
That explains the lack of squish. But I said the last song was a very fast 5 minutes. This is a very slow 5 minutes for me. Melody is pretty lacking. This is kind of like, I do think this would be, if I took one song off, it would be this. It's fine as a closure, to be honest with you. You want to put the album together and package it this way, I'll listen to the whole thing. That'll be the only time I'll listen to this, though. Unlike a lot of the records on here, there are like playlist kind of tracks on this album that I will just cherry pick out and just crank the shit out of, you know, especially we're talking the tracks on Signed One. But at the same time, this is a fun album to listen to. And in that sense, I think this it fits better than it does as a standalone track. I think Holy Water would have been a fine closer.
It would.
The rust in me. I don't know. But that said, what do we have for a rating here on New Damage?
I think I like this probably a little more than you. I give this 4 muckety mucks.
Okay. I'm not too far behind you. I give it 3 muckety mucks. So, I think it's the lowest rating I gave of anything on the record. But I should mention, I did note, and I don't think we've talked about Kim Thayil enough. This song, he does a lot of really cool playing on this track as far as like some of his the way he approaches things. I know Chris gets a lot of the credit because he's a songwriter, but man, Kim was just the perfect guitar player for this band, and Chris actually worked off of him for the songs for this band, and this song is a great example of that. And that'd probably be the one standout reason to kind of listen to it as a fan. It really does showcase him. Versus, you know, we've given a lot of love to Cameron and Ben Shepherd, and of course Cornell, next world singer. But Kim Thayil was really the guy for this band and deserves, you know, a good chunk of credit, man.
I agree. It's kind of funny that we got all the way through the end of this album when we hadn't mentioned his name once. So, I don't really know how
that
happened.
At least once, maybe. But he definitely deserves it. You know what I mean? Like he is so key to what they do here.
I was gonna say, along with Cornell, he was the other person that was talked about at the time, and still, really, those are the two guys you think of. And of course, we've been giving a lot of love to the rhythm section, which, you know, thank you very much. But he's an amazing guitar player, and nobody sounded like him
in a scene that really kind of needed that. You know what I mean? All these kind of musicians, they all kind of stood out, and it was kind of neat.
Kind of like Cantrell in a way. You know, he was a guitar hero, but he wasn't a guitar hero, but very much in the camp of Cantrell.
Yeah, I think Cantrell probably actually is a guitar hero, but Kim Thayil definitely was. Like, I mean, he was on the guitar magazines. He was everywhere. He was always being talked about, you know. So, yeah, it seems like as time has gone on, because he kind of really just stepped away when Soundgarden took a break. You really didn't hear from him until they came back. That's probably to his detriment in this sense. So, but, yeah, he's fucking pretty killer.
Yep, agreed.
All right. Well, I always give the guests the last final thoughts. So here's my final thoughts on the record. You know, I've basically shared a lot of personal stuff during this series that has basically been dug up going through it. I don't have anything new to add there, so I'm just going to go straight to the record. This record showed me that Soundgarden were really in a different league than anybody else from that scene. You know what I mean? And these are all amazing bands that we talk about here, but they just were, as musicians and a band, probably more importantly, were just on a different level. And that's not taking anything away from anybody else. But I read in Mark Yarm's book, Everybody Loves Our Town, and I apologize, I forget who said it, but it was somebody talking about a show they had played with Soundgarden where they actually headlined over Soundgarden earlier in the days. But like he said, like, everybody knew Soundgarden was better than everybody else in the scene because they had Chris Cornell. And I mentioned it earlier, he was definitely riding a creative wave from Temple of the Dog going into this thing. It's just, it's amazing how, I don't know, just how much he put out there during this short period of time. And I'm not talking about his life. I'm talking about like 90 to 92. He just cranked out some gold. He was just, I don't know, whatever, just knocking out of the park. But for the music, to the melody, to the lyrics, he was a next level talent. And then you talk about him as a singer, he's one of the probably 5 greatest rock vocalists of all time, period. This record stays at number 2 for me. Rolling Stone got this one right. My guest, Kevin Williams.
I was going to say the exact same thing, that Rolling Stone actually got this one right. This is the number 2 best grunge album of all time. And in my opinion, I don't think Soundgarden would ever get to this level again. As good as the rest of their albums are, to me, this is the pinnacle. This is the height of Soundgarden firing on all cylinders. And this is what, you know, before this, people knew who Chris Cornell was, but this established him as a icon, you know, just a rock icon, a god in the, you know, sense of a vocalist and a presence. And you know, they carried all this forward with their next releases. But to me, musically, they never got to the same place. This is just a golden album to me.
Tell the audience about the In Obscuria podcast, so where they can find you and what's going on over there, man.
Yeah, so if you want to check out what we're all about, go to inobscuria.com. But basically, the tagline there is we talk about the lost, the forgotten, and the should have been. So I take from my personal collection, everything that we play is something that I own. And I take pride in that in a way. And sometimes I don't take pride in that. But we basically take various themes, genres, or decades, or what have you. But we just make a, you know, our purpose to either play something that either you've forgotten, maybe at one point it was big, but, you know, only for a minute and most people have forgotten it, or we'll play a band that no one's ever heard of. We even do some local bands sometimes. I even play my own band and nobody's ever heard of that band. So, you know, and we do, and then things that have been lost, you know, maybe it's a band that had a push and for whatever reason, it just didn't click with people. So we try to search out those things that are a little more obscure. I try to stay away from the bands that everybody knows, but I may tie a band back to a big band like Metallica. Like we did a show on Metallica bands that were made by Metallica. So things like that.
It was a very smooth first episode, probably one of the most polished first episodes of a podcast I've ever heard. Was it something that you were sitting on for a while? Like, had you kind of like, I don't know, fleshed it out for proof of concept kind of thing there?
No, not at all. In fact, it's our first episode, still our number one download. And I listened back to it recently and I was like, oh, this is horrible. I thought it was horrible. But no, I just kind of came up with the idea. And what really makes the podcast work is really my co-host. Mm-hmm. Just me talking about obscure music, people would snore. But what I do is I spring this stuff on him. He has no clue what we're going to talk. And so he is truly reacting a lot of times to something he's hearing for the first time. And I go back a long time with this guy, Robert Harrison, and he was a guitarist in a band that I was in the late 90s, early 2000s, called Big Jack Pneumatic. And, you know, he was the front man. So he's got that going for him. He's got some charisma and he's just a unique dude. And he always comes with a different approach. He looks at things a lot differently than I would. So that's what really makes it click.
I'm guessing people who listen to this show are familiar with it, but if you haven't checked it out, I highly recommend it. It's good to, you know, you always want two good hosts, and that always makes or breaks pretty much anything. You know, no matter how good you are or knowledgeable of the topic, if you're not entertaining, it's not great. And so, yeah, the back and forth between the two of you, it does work very well, and I highly recommend it.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Yeah, and for those who we actually have been friends now for a couple of years. We met in Nashville at Rockin' Pod before you started a podcast. I think Chris Sinzak introduced you to me. And I remember like the first my first memory of you is that like it was like Friday to Saturday you had two different denim vests. loaded with all different band patches. I was like, okay, this is commitment. This is yeah. you definitely earned your home ec badge. So
yeah, I like my battle vest. And of course, one of the only places I can wear my battle vest these days is at the Rockin' Pod Expo. So I have my original from the 80s, which is mostly hair bands and thrash bands. And so that was, you know, that's one that I wear. And then I have one that's a little more current that I've had since the late 90s, early 2000s. So
right on. Well, we're definitely looking forward to seeing you again this summer. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I thought it was funny. The first year I walk in and I see Ken Mills sitting in the hotel lounge as I walk in with my buddy, and you know, I go up and talk to him, but at the same time, I'm feeling like, I don't have a podcast. So these guys are going to think I'm just some weirdo who listens to podcasts and decided to travel to see them. So it was a little odd. And then I run into Sinzak and he goes, "Hey man, Baco's here." Like, he didn't even talk to me. He goes, "Hey man, Baco's here. He's over there," which is the first time we met.
Yeah. Okay. No, no, it was good. I remember, like, we hung out. We actually talked probably for the most part the first time, if I recall right, was that the Ron Keel. That it wasn't Ron Keel. He was the first band, like, with Angel that night. But I remember inside and outside, we caught up a little bit. And then I talked to you the next day and all that good stuff. But, you know, it's been a friendship that I've enjoyed. So.
Me too, man.
Well, thank you so much, Kevin, for coming on the show. Definitely check out the Ian Obscuria podcast. It's one of my favorites. It's one that I go to weekly. All the best to you and yours. And thank you again. I couldn't have enjoyed this more.
Whatever, dude.
All right, never mind. If he had anything there.
I was going to say agree, but I felt like I already said that.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.